This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Back in the Great Depression, Americans lost jobs, pinched pennies, and waited in lines for soup and bread. Times were tough, and so were the people. Stories of their hardship and perseverance have been passed down through the generations. In the new recession, Americans are forced again to make hard choices about spending, savings, and values. This week's Time Magazine cover story looks at America's new frugality. This hour on Point, the new era of retro thrift. You can join the conversation. Does your family have a story about surviving the Great Depression? Are you turning to it now to help you get through tough times? Joining me now from New York City is Nancy Gibbs. She's editor at large for Time Magazine. She wrote this week's cover story, The New Frugality. Nancy Gibbs, welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Nice to be here.
So Time Magazine sent out a platoon of reporters and pollsters all across the country to measure anecdotally and empirically what's changing in this new period of our lives. What does your reporting reveal about how this recession is changing people's lives?
Well, one thing we wanted to really explore is whether what we were experiencing, if we're headquartered here in New York, as our magazine is, or on the coasts or in any of the sort of white-hot centers of the financial downturn or the manufacturing downturn, was whether what we were experiencing was also being felt in small towns and agricultural areas, or whether it was more concentrated. And so one thing that really struck us was how widespread the reactions and the changes are across regions, across income levels. It is not as though, I think, as in past downturns, that certain sectors of the economy or regions of the country have been hit especially hard while the others just watch from the sidelines. This one has really captured everyone's attention and imagination and affected everyone's behavior.
A broad impact. You say in the piece that people are recalibrating their lives, obviously, but it's more than that. It's a reset, right?
Well, you almost hear more resolve than regret when you ask people about what they're doing differently. You don't hear, in the way you might expect, a lot of longing for the good old days when you could buy that flat-screen TV and essentially charge it to your children on the credit card that you're never going to have to repay. That attitude is just gone. And even after the recession is over, something like 82% of people say, yeah, I'm still going to pay off my credit card, and I'm never going to carry a balance again.
Mm. So it's changing behavior, not just now, but perhaps into the future.
Well, that's where, you know, of course you can never know. But the behavior that it's changing now, I think, is certainly deeper in even people who are making still what are very comfortable incomes say that they are cutting coupons more. They're shopping at discount stores. They're buying in bulk. They're doing things that they've never done before, in addition to cutting back on the things that everyone seems to be cutting back on.
There also, Nancy, seemed to be a recognition in the piece as I read it that the economy as we knew it is not coming back as before, even if credit does start flowing again and there is a return to profitability. I got the sense that, you know, where we were before, people understand this really was not sustainable. Is that an accurate assessment?
I think it is, and I would go even further and say to some extent people realize they don't want it to have been sustainable, that it was taking us maybe down a road that we didn't want to be going down. I've been likening this to, you know, all of us who are told over the years that we should eat well and exercise and spend time with our children, but it takes a heart attack before we actually do it. I think this year has sort of been the great national heart attack. And so it is literally true that people say they are exercising more and they're taking better care of themselves. You know, vitamin sales are up. And 29% of people say they are spending more time with their family, more time with their children, which especially interested me because it would seem natural that in an era of so much stress, when people also talk about being sleepless and worrying so much about the future, that that would strain our relationships with the people we're closest to. And yet people were four times as likely to say that their relationships with their children had gotten better since the economy turned down as said they had gotten worse.
Let's listen to President Obama. Here he is in a speech on the economy about a week ago at Georgetown University. He said there are signs of economic recovery, but he called for a change in American spending.
We cannot rebuild this economy on the same pile of sand. We must build our house upon a rock. We must lay a new foundation for growth and prosperity, a foundation that will move us from an era of borrow and spend to one where we save and invest.
Nancy Gibbs, give us the numbers about spending. What did you find?
We found that 63% of people said they had cut back on entertainment, 56% have cut their spending in restaurants, 38% are spending less at sporting events, 46% are spending less going to the movies, 49% are spending less on clothes, and on it goes, including, you know, you may discount many of those things as sort of luxuries, but 20% have not filled a prescription, 24% say they've not gone to the doctor because of the cost of it. And so, and 27% said that they've raided their college savings fund or their retirement savings fund in order just to keep paying the bills. And so it is not only a matter of people scaling back on things that they can easily do without. It's also, in many cases, people giving up things that they would have called necessities.
There was also a tangible sort of fear about reverting back to Depression-era conditions. Is that true?
I think that many of us saw, you know, in our parents' and our grandparents' generation, that even after the economy recovered, even during, you know, you see it in the days immediately following World War II, that the scars that were left from the decade before were still very much with people and often lasted all through their lifetimes. They never went back to thinking that profligacy was okay. And I think that it's too soon to know if this has left as deep a mark. A lot of it will probably depend on how long this recession extends and how deeply it is felt. You know, happily, we're not experiencing the kind of unemployment levels that occurred in the 1930s. But you still, when we asked people, and our sister publication, Money Magazine, too, asked people the impact they thought this would have on them going forward, very large majorities said that these changes were permanent. 94% said this will have a long-term effect on how they manage money. 74% said we will not trust advice from Wall Street again, and that even once the recession ends, they're going to keep on paying for things in cash, you know, keeping their credit cards in the drawer or in the safe deposit box and really trying not to use them. And that their children are likely to have been profoundly affected by this as well.
Let's bring some callers into this conversation. Ryan is up first. He's in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Ryan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead. Are you there, Ryan?
Hello? Oh, yep. I just, you know, prior to this economic crisis, I was one of many Americans that would do the careless extra spending. If I didn't go to a movie a few times a month, if I didn't eat out a couple times a week, I didn't feel like I was up to par with everybody else. And now, I've instead of working one full-time job to help myself go through school, I'm working three part-time jobs just because so many companies and businesses out there don't have the hours to give everybody. And I'm still doing what I got to do to get through school and make the money I need to make to pay my bills. And I've noticed that I spend way less. I don't go out and do the things, you know, all the extracurriculars.
So you and your friends are relearning how to save and work a little differently than you might have a few years ago?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. I'm taking the sack lunch every day.
Mm. Ryan, thank you. Nancy Gibbs, it's an interesting point from a younger caller. Did you see a generational change or difference in the numbers?
We absolutely did. You know, people who are between 18 and 35, for instance, are four times as likely to say that they've borrowed money from family and friends as older people were. And in a way, you know, this is not at all surprising because as much as we've seen that the job losses, for instance, have hit men disproportionately because they've often centered in manufacturing businesses, they've also hit young people disproportionately. The disappearance of job opportunities for people under 30 is a very significant part of this. And so needing to think differently about the whole idea of a career and how you might build it, having to juggle multiple jobs at the same time may be, you know, I think foreshadowing a different way of thinking about one's professional life that's going to last, again, even after this recovery takes hold, that we will have a generation of workers that is accustomed to moving around their jobs more often or having more than one employer, not just over the course of their professional life, but simultaneously.
And also a younger generation, really, Nancy, that's never been so heavily burdened with debt. And as the recession eases, they'll have to struggle for years really to pay down that debt if it's not taken care of now.
Well, one of the most interesting groups of people that we spoke with were college admissions and financial aid people, because, of course, they were suddenly confronting families for whom education has always been a huge priority, who've been saving to pay for school their entire lives and are now finding themselves faced with very hard decisions of, can I justify, you know, having my child be, you know, an art history major at a liberal arts college as opposed to doing something, quote unquote, more practical, decisions that they really did not expect they would be wrestling with, and very suddenly having to reassess what they were capable of, having to postpone college or graduate training and make some very hard-headed decisions about the amount of debt that they're prepared to take on compared with the advantage that they believe that educational level will give them in the job market.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new frugality, about how tough times are changing how we think about spending and saving and our futures. Nancy Gibbs is with us today. She is an editor-at-large for Time magazine. She wrote this week's cover story, The New Frugality. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Martha Olney. She's an adjunct professor of economics at UC Berkeley and the author of Buy Now, Pay Later: Advertising Credit and Consumer Durables in the 1920s. Nice to have you with us, Martha.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So put this period of time that we're in into context in the conversation we just had with Nancy and contextualize for us, you know, the severity of this recession that we're facing in terms of unemployment percentages and per capita income with what happened during the Great Depression.
The Great Depression began in the fall of 1929. The peak in activity was actually in August of 1929. The current recession began in December of 07. And similarly in both recessions, the first several months of a recession are, as you're in it, probably not terribly noticeable. The 1929 downturn was, of course, punctuated by the crash of the stock market in the end of October and things. But the economy was, frankly, in a relatively mild recession in 1929. And then what happened was in 1930, 1931, essentially the bottom fell out of consumption spending and consumers cut back. And their cutback in spending is what turned a run-of-the-mill recession into the Great Depression. Mm. So the concerns that some of us have are the similarities in that regard, because the recession that we're in now, as I said, began in December of 07. And there were signs, you know, you could pick it up as you saw a decline starting in construction spending and then spreading to manufacturing. But it was really the bursting of the housing bubble in the current episode that has led to a huge drop in consumption spending. Some work that I've done, I've looked at the use of home equity loans to finance consumption spending. And home equity loans, when people are able to take equity out of their house and then use that to pay for college educations or pay for a car or pay to travel or pay for whatever it is they want to pay for, the amount of money that we all were taking out of our homes when we talked about using our houses as ATMs added another 10% to our take-home pay, our disposable income, as recently as 2006. And the withdrawals of that equity from our home, the use of our homes as ATM, has stopped. And so if you imagine that, in essence, what everyone has experienced is a 10% or more cut in the amount of money they have to spend, And that is having a tremendous impact on our consumption spending now. And in that sense, it's similar to what happened in the Great Depression.
So let me interrupt you for just a moment, because I'd like to focus back on what Nancy spoke of in this Time magazine reporting, the fact that Americans are changing now, how they are spending, how they're looking ahead, learning to be more thrifty. What other things have we learned or should we have learned from the Great Depression about credit and debt that could help us now in the Great Recession?
Well, there's what we economists learned, and there's what we people learned. I suppose that just said that economists are not people, but let me go here. what the economists learn is what has been called in the textbooks the paradox of thrift. And the notion is that thrift is a virtue. Mm. At least our grandparents thought that thrift was a virtue, that saving was virtuous, that it's something that is good for us as families. And I think that's something that we're rediscovering. Frankly, as someone who teaches Econ 1, it's been very difficult for many years to explain to students this notion of the paradox of thrift, because I had to take a lot of time to explain to them the idea that saving was a good thing and saving was virtuous. But if you'd go with me that saving is virtuous, the downside of saving, the paradox, is that when we save, when we cut back, as Nancy said, on our entertainment spending and our restaurant spending and our sporting goods and our movies and our clothes and even what we spend at the doctor's, that means that there are fewer people who have jobs working in those entertainment venues or those restaurants or those sporting venues or in the movie theater or making or selling the clothes. Mm-hmm. And so the paradox of thrift is that what may be good for us as individuals and as families is bad for us as an economy, because when you and I don't spend, then somebody else doesn't have a job.
Nancy Ibbs, when did thrift stop being a value, as Martha refers to here? It became folly.
Well, I would say, you know, that the Depression started it, as she suggested, because it invited economists to recast thrift. One of them wrote that it was the contemptible vice which threw sand in the gears of our consumer economy. And that was sort that was sort of the attitude. It wasn't just that it stopped being a value. It became, certainly in this our last generation, it became a folly. Saving was for suckers. It meant that you were going to miss the ride, die leaving money on the table when you could have lived it up. You know, there's an old saying, there are no pockets in a shroud. And so that was very much, I think, the attitude that took hold. We went from saving at one point something like 15% of our income, and by the 1980s it was down to 4%. And last year it was in negative numbers, and now it is suddenly back up to 5%. Mm. And so that's a very dramatic kind of bell curve in our attitude of whether, you know, the best use of our money is another flat screen TV or another certificate of deposit.
Mm. My callers I have to get to some listeners here. Martha, hold on just a moment. Let's get in Ray first. He's in Charlottesville, Virginia. Ray, welcome to On Point.
Oh, hi, Jane.
Hi.
My father lived through the Depression. He was 7 years old when it happened, and he delivered ice to make ends meet. So he knew a lot about having to survive. I myself have had to do a major downturn here. I'm feeling the effects of the economy. I've cut up my credit cards. I had to give back a sports car I was driving. I had to go out and buy a used car so I wouldn't have a car payment. I don't go out as much. I agree with your guest's idea about thrift and the paragon of thrift, but I don't see this recession going away until two things happen. The two things that everybody has to contend with, whether you're rich or poor, are gas prices and food prices. And nobody's talking about how the gas prices, when they went up radically in mid-2008 last year, and how food went up, those prices impacted on everyone's budget.
Mm.
If you're spending $75 to $100 a week on gas, you can't pay your mortgage anymore.
Right.
You can't pay your credit cards anymore. And we're all scared. We've been shocked by these high gas prices. And consumers, the middle class, are scared. We're afraid it's going to happen again. So we're hunkering down. We're saving every penny because we don't know if it's going to happen again.
Ray, thank you for calling. Nancy Gibbs, you know, in many ways it's hard to be thrifty when food prices and gas prices and everything else around you is so high.
I think that's certainly true, and this is why, you know, you now have people saying that they actually feel guilty if they buy anything except what they absolutely need. That's something like, you know, 59% of people said that. And so The notion that you need to hoard your money so that you have it for the absolute necessities, and if you have anything else, you save it for the necessities you're going to need tomorrow, that completely crowds out all the things that Martha was listing of the sort of that have been driving our consumer economy for years.
We have pulled some voices actually from the Depression era for this program today. Here's the first of those clips. Carrie Conley found herself a single mother with six kids to feed during the Depression. She and her son Jerry talked to StoryCorps in 2007 about trying to feed all those kids when her husband left her.
When he left, I just said, Lord, what am I going to do with all these kids by myself? And I just had a small amount of money for food because everything had to come out of the small check that I was getting.
How did you get by?
Well, neck bones was 10 cents a pound, and I would go to the store and I'd get 10 pounds. I'd buy lima beans, black-eyed peas, something boiled for every day in the week. So one of my sons and I said he didn't eat black-eyed peas because he ate so many.
A lot of voices from the past. Nancy Gibbs, I was curious in the Time Magazine article, you found that there was no increase in happiness in your polling after households exceeded the median income of $50,000 a year. In other words, at a certain point, happiness had nothing to do with the money that you earn. And in these recessionary times, that was an interesting point to be brought up. Do you think that's, I mean, what do you make of that particular number?
Well, one of the statistics that struck me most and confused me at first was we asked people whether you think that the American dream is going to be harder to achieve 10 years from now than it has been. And a large majority say yes. But then you also ask, do you think that America's best days are ahead or whether, you know, the 1990s were our high point and it's all going to be downhill from here? And 56% say our best days are ahead. They think things will be harder and will be better. That the country will emerge stronger from this. And in a sense, I think that speaks to a sense people have that this experience is going to help us build some muscles we need and revive some values that we had lost. And this is why, again and again, we heard in people's discussions, often after they had detailed all the ways in which they had been retrenching in their personal habits, they're saying, but there are good things about this. I sort of like the fact that Sunday night now we're going to stay home and play Scrabble. We're not going to feel like we have to be out, going out, doing something or spending on something. Not only the sense of family closeness, of community closeness, but that this was going to make us stronger and both individually and collectively. And that, I think, perhaps is a residue of what we watched from the generation that came out of the Depression and soon was christened the greatest generation, a sense that it's a cliche, but that, you know, that which does not kill you makes you stronger. We heard that over and over again, and we heard a kind of steadfastness and resolve in people discussing how they were changing, including talking about, you know, learning how to grow their own food, which isn't practical for a lot of people. But I don't think it's an accident that when we went down to the organic nursery in Austin, Texas, that their business is up 500% this year. There are things that are growing and that people are devoting their time and energy and money to that are very much, in my mind, you know, very much in keeping with the atmosphere of frugality that we've been exploring.
Martha, I think, take that to the Great Depression. I mean, did you, in your research, did that hold true? Did people feel the same way that that crisis would make them stronger?
The interesting thing about the Great Depression is there's two sort of almost contrary things about it. One is the unemployment rate was extremely high. So in 1932, it peaked at over 25% and stayed above 10% until the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The other thing is that it was an era before television. And when I talked, you were talking to that family that you had the clip of. My parents were both raised by single mothers in the Great Depression. And my aunt would tell me, you know, we didn't know that we were poor because there wasn't television to show us what the alternative was. There was just the neighborhood and the friends and the families that we knew. And so I think that's an interesting difference, I think, between then and now, is that the ways in which we compare ourselves and the sort of you know, the phrase keeping up with the Joneses. In the 1930s, the families that families knew, and this sort of how are we doing relative to everyone else, and do we feel like we're suffering, came from a relatively small circle of individuals. And today, when you hear, you know, you look at how you're doing and compare that with everyone else, you're not necessarily comparing it with your neighbors. You may not even know your neighbors. You're comparing it with what you see on television and in the movies. And it's a very almost false comparison, I think. And it would be very interesting to hear from a student of culture to talk about the role of the media in terms of television and movies in spurring the whole boom that we lived through over the last 20 years.
Let's get another couple of calls in here before our break. Tallahassee, Florida is where Maurice is. Maurice, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Go ahead.
May I tell you how personally validating today's conversation is? I'm 33, and I'm in Tallahassee, Florida, and my life has changed dramatically over the last few years in this economy. Mm-hmm. But I'm very optimistic, and I've been sharing a lot of my optimism with some of my friends on Facebook and Twitter. And people my age think that I'm nuts when I say that look at all the great opportunities, look at the bright side and the silver lining for this dark economic cloud.
And see, what practically speaking do you see as the silver lining?
Well, for one thing, I bought more stock in the last 2 months than I've bought in my entire life. And I've seen some of those, you know, I have good returns already. And so I'm imagining in 2 years I'll really, you know, be improving. I'm seeing some of my friends buy homes for the first time ever, when 2 or 3 years ago there's a lot of stress about whether or not they could get financing and buy in certain neighborhoods in Virginia Beach and Tallahassee. So these are great things. These are things that we couldn't have without, you know, this cyclical event that's occurring in our economy right now. Mm.
Maurice, thank you. There's some optimism of which you speak, Nancy. Here's another call from Salt Lake City. Barbara is on the line. Barbara, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How are you today?
Well, go ahead. Thank you.
I have a little different take on what I hope this problem will bring to us. Mm-hmm. As I told your screeners, I'm turning 75 next week, and so I was born at the end of the Depression. And we lived in a small town in Idaho, and my mother was a waitress there. And I can remember her saying that you had to be the best waitress you could possibly be, because if you weren't, there were five people behind waiting to take your job. Mm. I am hoping that this problem that we're having now will encourage the employers and the employees to find themselves being trained and learning how to do their job, how to wait on people, what their stock is while they're checking you out, not talking on their friend on the cell phone.
So a sharper focus on service. Nancy, will you speak to that?
I wrote about an essay called Queen for a Day after this exact phenomenon kept on occurring, where, you know, you go to buy a microwave and the salesman is offering to carry your shopping bags up and down the aisles, and again and again and again, the restaurant that used to treat customers as though maybe they really weren't good enough to be eating that restaurant's food, where suddenly the level of hospitality was exponentially higher. And I do think that the notion of the service economy and of thinking about what customers want and how to lure them in and entertain them and inspire them and engage them and keep them loyal is something that retailers have devoted enormous energy to, and as they have had to, and often very creatively. Whether that will last when the recovery comes is an open question, but there has certainly been an explosion, I think, in the efforts to make people feel like their money is being well spent. A great many people talk about value and the sense of getting what you getting the value for your money.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a new era of American thrift in tough economic times today. We're speaking this hour with Nancy Gibbs. She's editor-at-large for Time Magazine. She wrote this week's cover story, The New Frugality. Also with us, Martha Olney. She's an adjunct professor of economics at University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Buy Now, Pay Later, Advertising Credit and Consumer Durables in the 1920s. Here's another voice from the era of the Great Depression. One of the most iconic images of that period is of Americans standing in line for soup and bread. But sometimes it was more exciting to run after it instead of waiting around. So here's Manny Diaz talking to an oral history project called StoryCorps about chasing after government trucks full of fruit.
Everybody used to run with baby carriage, with push carts, with pillowcases to pick up the grapes that were dumped by the U.S. Army trucks. And then we would bring those grapes home. And this was during Prohibition, mind you. And we would put the grapes in a bathtub, crush them, and then go to Woolworth on 116th Street, where you could pick up the burlap bag to cover the grapes, the yeast, the sugar. So we would cover this bathtub and let it sit for about a month, which is what it takes to ferment, you know.
Martha Olney, what an image, huh? What's the downside? Yeah, what's the downside to being thrifty? Where do you draw the line in this new era, the recession we're in?
So the downside to being thrifty is not a personal downside. The downside to being thrifty is a macroeconomic or an aggregate downside. And as I mentioned before, the downside to being thrifty is that when we're thrifty, we're not spending. And when we're not spending, we're not generating jobs for other people. And so the downside is that there's a real risk that this recession that we're in could reach what we economists call an unemployment equilibrium, which is to say that we could get to a point of, say, 9-10% unemployment, and then, absent the temporary stimulus package of the Obama administration, just be stuck there. The downturn is really spurred by a big drop in our spending, in consumer spending. And if that consumer spending doesn't return, and there are perfectly good reasons for it not to return, but if that consumer spending does not return, then absent some other type of spending to fill in that gap, we're going to be stuck here for a while. And that's the sense in which this is like the Great Depression. The Great Depression had a peak of 25% unemployment, but the reason we call it the Great Depression is that unemployment was above 10% for over a decade. And that's the risk, and that's the downside. That's the fear. I want to go back to one thing that Nancy said.
Okay, sure.
Nancy said in her introduction, she said families feeling like they shouldn't let their child major in art history. I want to say to all of those parents out there of college students, please let your child major in art history if that's their love. They have only four years in college, and it's their one chance to really explore their love. And that I see so many unhappy students whose parents are pushing them to major in business, and it's not their love, and it's not what they want to do, and they're miserable, and they would be such happier, better, more fulfilled people if we let them do what they love now.
Nancy,
so that's my plug as a college professor.
I'll let you respond to that briefly before I go to phones.
You know, I think it's exactly that is making this so painful. Likewise, parents that have their children who got into the college of their dreams but did not get as good a financial aid package compared with another college that is offering more money but that isn't as strong in the subject they want to study. Or, you know, they're making decisions between the things that they love and the dreams that they've had for a long time and the sudden economic reality they face. And it's heartbreaking. And, the college officials we talked about how painful it is to them to deal with these families who are having to make choices like this that they just did not expect would be what they would be facing at this point.
That's right. Here's another call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bill is on the line. Bill, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Wonderful program. Thanks.
Thank you.
A couple of things. I noticed when I was traveling recently in Florida, which is a rapidly developing and perhaps overdeveloped place, that the most full parking lots I saw were not at the malls, but at Salvation Army and Goodwill. And I figure if people are spending less and reusing things that other people own that are still perfectly good, I'm not so concerned about a loss of jobs that may be more jobs for people in China who are making inferior quality goods that Walmart is selling back up the block. I realize that I'm, like, oversimplifying stuff here, but that's just another point of view. I'm a member of the old frugality. Like, I come from people who never stopped being frugal since the Depression.
Hmm.
I still make stuff if I can't buy it. If times get tough, I don't whine too much about it. I don't have a credit card. If I need to eat meals at a church, I do it. I know some people who can, you know, tell me where the good ones are, and I don't have any shame about that. So a lot of people who fear losing a little bit maybe are out of touch with how much they've actually gained in terms of, you know, the balance between how much I want and how much I actually need. That really varies according to people, and you can get by with a little less without feeling like I'm, depleted or demoralized. It's just another challenge of life.
Bill, thank you. Thanks for the call. Bob is on the line from Bethel, Vermont. Bob, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
Okay. I agree with the gentleman calling before me. Yes, you know, I do not feel any shame, you know, because, as you know, sometimes people need, you know, a hand to get by. And also, my family, my sisters and I, you know, we're still teaching our great nieces and nephews and their grandchildren from our old school books.
Mm, and how are they taking it? Are they listening?
Yes, because, you know, it's their basic arithmetic, their ABCs and so forth like that. I mean, children now are raised in the computer age. You know, my grandson knows more about computers than I do.
I thought you meant you were teaching them about thrift and how to spend less.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes, because not only that, you know, and my grandson asked, Granddad, why do I have such an old book? I said, this old book is invaluable. You know, and not only that, but as with our economy today, you know, I was raised in a poor family, and we had no choice but to be frugal and thrifty. And I could give, you know, I'm a poor veteran now, and I could give an economics class on frugality. You know, because I don't go to movies anymore. I eat out once a year now because I grew up in the food service industry, as it were. So that is a valuable trade that I have been taught, to where a lot of the people, you know, don't know the aspects of, you know, cost effectiveness, buying in bulk or so forth.
And you sound happy. Bob, thank you very much. Nancy Gibbs, let me go back to another point in your story. There was a point about relationships at the workplace. Would you speak to that, the strain among bosses and those beneath them?
I guess this shouldn't surprise us, but as we asked how the Great Recession has affected people's relationships, the one relationship that has come under greater strain, of course, is between employees and their bosses. They're getting along just fine with coworkers and, as I said, even better with friends and family. But I think it's natural that at a time where people are even who have never thought about questions of job security before are suddenly looking around and seeing empty offices around them, seeing people let go who always had imagined their jobs were perfectly secure. It naturally introduces all kinds of tension and suspicion in the employer-employee relationship. I think that was inevitable.
Here's another line now. Ivan is in Cambridge. Welcome, Ivan.
Hi, thanks. Hi. For having me on, Jane.
Okay.
It's a terrific show.
Thank you.
Just wanted to go back to a point that was made earlier, which I thought was fascinating, on how we make comparisons. In other words, how we judge how well we're doing, and the idea of television not being in the around in the Great Depression to make those kinds of comparisons. And my supporting observation has to do with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1985. Most people don't realize that prior to 1985, prior to Gorbachev's Glasnost initiatives, his openness initiatives, most Soviets weren't able to make relevant comparisons between their standard of living and, say, people in Central Europe or even in Western Europe. And the political ramifications of suddenly in the mid-80s to late-80s being able to make those comparisons were tremendous and really did a lot to sort of undermine the control and the legitimacy of the Communist Party there. Now, that segues to another point, because I think it's just excellent support for this, which is how do we get these sort of set points of when we know we're doing okay even when we make comparisons, and how do they go? One of the arguments was made that the Great Depression lasted for decades. So it seems like in order to have a better idea of how much consumption, how we're doing well is okay, it would take decades for those things to change. And I think I'll just end with this. I think the relevant little mini experiment here is with gas prices. You know, last summer they peaked. And people began to change their behavior, their expectations about consuming, about making trips, about all kinds of things having to do with fuel. But then in the spring, you know, in January and February of this year, prices dropped dramatically. Did those changes stick? Did people say, wow, you know, we're going to make these long-term changes? Or are they saying, well, you know, whatever is happening to us now that's bad, we'll get through it, and then we'll be able to go back to just borrowing money to buy iPods and, you know, other sort of, I don't want to pick on iPods, but any sort of...
No, I hear you, Ivan, and it's a good comment. Martha, speak to that about these set points.
The evidence on the gas price effect is that, you're right, that behavior swung away from using gas last summer when the gas prices were $4.50, $4.70 a gallon. Gas prices now are around $2 a gallon. Behavior has swung back, but not all the way back. So some people who switched out of their car and into public transit have stayed with public transit. Some people who went out of their car and onto their bike have stayed with the bike. But some of the people who switched out of their cars are back in their cars. Hmm. So there was... Not the full effect is still there, but a partial effect has. I don't know if we want to call this a long-term effect. It's not even been a year since we were at $4.50 a gallon, but has remained even after gas prices are back at $2 a gallon.
To Arlington, Massachusetts now, Tamara is on the line. Hi, Tamara. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to, I guess, express some skepticism that this idea of new frugality is actually going to hold.
Yep, you don't buy it. Okay.
I don't buy it. I feel like my husband and I got out of college in 1990, and there was no jobs for us. Mm-hmm. And then we watched again at the dot-com around 2000, the whole thing kind of fall apart. And we made really serious changes and tore up the credit cards and, you know, really started to build a life that was based on, you know, good, sound financial principles. And we watched all of our neighbors, and it was like they went through the years 2004 to 2005 and 6, like on this drug, you know. It's as if they hadn't experienced the same reality that we had experienced 5 and 10 years before. And, you know, $500 birthday parties for four-year-olds was the norm. And it's really hard to teach your kids to be frugal when the whole culture is going mad. Hmm.
Tamara, thank you. I appreciate your call. Nancy, would you speak to the caller? Speak to Tamara?
I have actually heard parents talk about what a relief it is now that it's so much easier to say no to their kids, that somehow they always knew that they should be saying no more often but couldn't quite bring themselves to, and now they have the perfect excuse. That has come up again and again. There's no way to predict, and I think it's useful to have an element of skepticism about this, what the long-term impact is. And as I say, a lot depends on how long this lasts. But there are some things that we had been told were not possible, or had come to believe were not possible, like the idea that your 401k could drop half its value in a few months, that we now know is entirely possible. And so even after a recovery comes, even after people think it's not reckless to take a vacation and go back to spending perhaps more normally, we still have this knowledge now that we did not have before, had not fully absorbed before, about where we might be vulnerable and what might occur in a circumstance like this. And I don't think that that is likely to be erased. And so that knowledge, I think, is what is likely to have a lasting impact on the decisions that people make going forward.
Let's take one last call from Pocatello, Idaho. CW is on the line. CW, welcome to you.
Yes, and I'm going right to it.
Okay, thank you.
During the Korean War, the thing went completely crazy. And about the time the prices went up on everything, Congress placed a limit on the raising of wages. And this removed the surplus from the working man to have cash. And this created our system of credit as we think of it today. Mm. And this is what has caused an awful lot of our problem. Men weren't making the money versus the price of what they're paying for.
So do you see a shift, CW? Do you see a shift in our culture today?
Absolutely.
And what do you think about that?
Buy everything on credit. Where we had cash on hand, we could buy a car for cash.
Hmm.
It was certainly a different time, that's for sure. Nancy Gibbs, I'd like to ask you what your reaction and to the feedback that you received from your readers about this story on thrift.
Every time I have written about this subject since the fall when the world started to come apart, the reaction has overwhelmingly been that of people thinking, oh, yeah, I thought it was just me, of either being mm-hmm. embarrassed about spending money on things, you know, the opposite of conspicuous consumption. Now you have, you know, people being much more who are perfectly comfortable financially being very reluctant to flaunt wealth, to people who feel vulnerable for the first time, having a sense of almost camaraderie that, okay, everyone in the community I know is having the same experience and it is bringing us together. I do think that what is distinctive about this experience for us as a country is that it is affecting so many more people. And so when you write about it, you essentially are letting people know, yes, it isn't just you or it isn't just your town. This is something that is the dominant conversation for us no matter where we are and no matter what our circumstances are. Some version of this is playing out around every kitchen table in the country. Mm.
Well, thank you very much for your time, both of you. Nancy Gibbs is the editor-at-large for Time Magazine. Her most recent article is called The New Frugality, the cover story of this week's Time Magazine. Thanks very much, Nancy. Really appreciate it.
Very nice to be with you.
Thank you. And Martha Olney, joining us from Berkeley, California. She's an adjunct professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. She's the author of Buy Now, Pay Later, Advertising Credit, and Consumer Durables in the 1920s. I really appreciate your perspective as well, Martha. Thanks.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us at Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.